Russia has test-fired two nuclear-capable missiles, one underwater, one in the air. Russia is also closing in on possibly completely capturing two major cities, Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, and Russia is languishing under new sanctions on their oil industry from the United States. A lot has been going on lately, and we are privileged today to have somebody back from firsthand conversation with on many of these issues from Moscow, in Larry the Shirt Johnson, former CIA analyst, Sonar21.com and Son of a New American Revolution on Substack.com. Larry, first of all, I hope that you can actually keep awake because I know you've had somewhat of a long jet lag to get home.
I had my afternoon nap already. My body's still trying to adjust. Seven time zones is quite a leap.
Yeah, and I wonder if we were talking about just before you came on. I mean, this is not that earth-shattering stuff, but it's kind of like amazing. Tell us about because of the U.S. situation where they can no longer have direct flights, what did you have to do to get back from Russia?
So at 10 a.m. Monday morning, U.S. time, East Coast time, I'm at the airport in Moscow, Sheremetyevo Airport. And take a five and a half hour flight from Moscow to Doha. To get into Doha, the Qatar, then I do a 3 hour layover, three to four hour layover. Then I hop my flight from Doha to JFK, which is 14 hours.
Ooh.
And then in JFK, I have a 3 hour layover to catch my flight to come back to Sarasota, but I have to go via Charlotte. So I get to Charlotte and hang out there for 2 hours. They got good food in the airport. That's the upside. I left at 10 a.m. Monday and got into Sarasota at 6 p.m. Tuesday.
That's what, would you say, like 31 hours, something like that?
Yeah, 31 hours.
That is a whale of a trip, yeah. Man. That is, just a 14-hour flight alone from Doha is just like, sounds like a backbreaker. But to add all those others, that's quite an effort to go through a flight.
It's certainly an odyssey. So,
but that's just what it takes right now, because I guess the United States doesn't want to make it easy for anybody to go to Russia because, well, they're the evil people, as certainly we know. At least that's what we claim. Lot going on here. So I'm real interested in some of the conversations that you had while you were in Moscow. But let's look at some of the bigger ones that are making news first, and that is the Burevestnik, new basically cruise missile type with the extended range, or not even extended range, but almost permanent range, if that's even a phrase that you can use, that it can literally fly until they decide to stop it because of the nuclear fuel cycle. What is the concept or what is the view in Moscow about what they think that means?
Well, they've got something special from their standpoint. They believe that they have made a dramatic technological breakthrough. You know, the U.S. had a project called SLAM back in the 1960s. It was ended in 1974. Stephen Bryan has a good piece on it at his Substack. But it was, again, the U.S. tried to develop a nuclear reactor on a cruise missile. Now, I bring up what the U.S. people commenting on the Burevestnik are very dismissive of it. Oh, it's nothing. Oh, they've got, But it's a breakthrough. It's a dramatic breakthrough, at least from the Russian standpoint. They've solved a number of technical issues. One is how to contain the radiation. Two, how to cool the reactor as it's running. But they have now, I don't think Putin's blowing smoke. And I talked earlier today, again, with the retired general, Evgeny Mushinsky. And he, too, was saying, this is pretty important. Yeah, because it's not so much from the military application. Yes, from a military application, Russia could equip these with nuclear warheads and launch them. And then they can fly. Nobody knows how long they can stay aloft. With a nuclear reactor, you're probably looking at, the potential of 6 months, a year. It could be up there that long flying around because it doesn't have to stop to be refueled. It doesn't have a limited fuel tank. It's an unlimited nuclear reactor, fission. But Its real importance will come in the commercial area because put that on a spaceship. Spaceship can go anywhere then. It's not limited to, you don't have to calculate how much fuel do we have on board. And they're saying the same about the Poseidon. So the research that they've been doing with respect to the nuclear reactors is something that they can apply and put into in this case, a submarine. I tell you what, it means they also could probably do nuclear-fueled aircraft. You know, that's out there as a possibility too now. You know, it's typical of the United States. We're just so dismissive. Oh, those Russians, they make crap. They haven't, they don't match up to us. And yet here we sit in the United States. We don't have a single operationally combat hypersonic missile. Not one. Russians got five, if you count the Oreshnik and the Iskander. The Iskander is described as the poor man's hypersonic. But they got five that have been deployed that are combat proven. We don't have a single one. Then they've got the Oreshnik, which is, it capabilities defy anything the West has. And then they've come out with these two, both the Poseidon and the Budryavtsev cruise missile. So you've got the advances on that front. You've got the advances on drones that, you know, the United States can't match. You've got decided advantage with Russia on the artillery. So, and then glide bombs. So, you know, what we're looking at is Russia is demonstrating a military level of competence that the United States cannot and has not matched.
You know, that scene right there on the screen, I think, is everybody's talked about, and we've actually shown on our show here, the Poseidon that could go out and basically have a tsunami start and just swamp it, an entire coastal area, et cetera. But what they showed here, and I think it's going to pop up in a second, is you can take out an aircraft carrier battle group, one shot, and take the entire thing out. I mean, that could potentially render your entire surface fleet irrelevant in the event of a full-on war.
Yeah, well, in fact, the one thing the Russians have proven, and this is one of the biggest takeaways I had from my 14 days in Moscow, they do not target civilians. There may be civilians, there will be incidental casualties, but the Russians, not just the Russians, go back to the days of the Soviets in World War II. What a contrast with the West. The United States and the United Kingdom routinely targeted and killed civilians with our strategic bombing campaigns. You know, Dresden and Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We killed civilians.
All of North Korea. We wiped out virtually every city and village in North Korea during the armistice period.
Yeah.
Negotiating. People don't talk about that one.
Whereas the Russians, you don't have a single case of Russia using strategic bombing of civilian areas during World War II. They didn't do it. And the current Russian government, again, the West likes to say, oh, they're killing these civilians. Okay, where are the names? Give us the names. Because if you hit a hotel, you supposedly got registered guests. Man, you can put those names right out there. Showed us Betty Lou and their little daughter, Mary. But that doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because the Russians are killing foreign mercenaries and Ukrainian military personnel, which is why they don't release the names. So Russia's got this thing about not killing civilians.
Now what do you say? Because there are some, like some videos where we've seen some Russian drones that have actually gone into apartment buildings and other missiles, whether that's air defense missiles that missed or even some of the Russian ones that may have come in there. But it seems like there's a lot of some buildings and houses that have been hit. What do you say to those?
Well, most of those have been from Ukrainian air defense missiles that have gone off course and not Russian missiles, you know. That's just that's the reality. But again, where are the names? Give the list of the names. We got far more. We got the names of the civilians that are being killed routinely by the Ukrainians with the backing of the West that are shelling. They're not hitting military targets in Donetsk and in Bryansk and certainly in Kursk last year. Yeah. They were hitting civilian areas.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the thing we do in the West. Andrei Martyanov is, you know, it's one of his, you know, points of emphasis that this tradition in the West of killing civilians. I mean, look, we did it to the American Indians. Okay. We didn't just fight warriors. We went in and wiped out villages and killed women and children. That's our history, unfortunately. And yeah, that's what I came away with from the Russians. They reject that. And that's where, as the West tries to, you know, do this scaremongering about, oh, they're going to launch a tidal wave to swamp New York City. Well, while New York City could use a pretty good flushing, I don't doubt that. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of a toilet bowl there, but the Russians are going to, you know, they'll take out strategic targets. They'll take out a carrier task force. They'll take out a military base, but that's not what they want to do, but that's what we've been pushing them to do.
Yeah. Let's hope it doesn't get that. It stays theoretical. Let's move on to the next issue here that really is starting to, I think, take up a lot more energy, and that is a couple of potential major long-term, months-long battles that could be getting closer to an end, and that is in Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk. And in Pokrovsk especially, there are some indications, and I looked as recently as this morning in the current update, that there is was pretty significant advances by the Russians overnight to almost completely close off that boundary there. It still has a ways to go, but they already have it under fire control, and there is the risk of somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000. It's to dispute the numbers,
right?
But there are a lot of troops in there that they either are going to have to die in place or withdraw pretty soon, because if Russia closes off those pincers, that is a major, major loss. How is that being viewed?
Oh, well, it's the Russians are patient. They're going to win. They've laid out the negotiating terms. Those terms have been rejected by Donald Trump and by the West. And the Russians have, you know, shrugged their shoulders. They're going to keep moving forward. We get this criticism frequently out of, you know, particularly the retired general set, you know, the Jack Keynes and Ben Hodges and such, about how slow the Russians are going, how inept they are. The distance of this contact line in Ukraine, it's like the distance from Washington, D.C. to Miami, okay? How if you had 600,000 troops, Danny, how much concentration could you have all along that line? You know, how many are you going to put in Florida and then in Georgia? And then in North Carolina and South Carolina and then Virginia until you reach up to Washington, D.C. You know, it is all of a sudden you begin to appreciate that's a huge area, and the ability. Yeah, you could concentrate forces in one area, but that doesn't deal with that entire line. What we've seen happening since the start of February 2025 is, in contrast to 2023, 2024, where Russia would focus on one area, say Avdiivka or Bakhmut.
Yeah.
Now they are pressing all along that line of contact, and it's really creating some problems for the Ukrainians.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about this Pokrovsk area here, but there's also areas down here in the Avdiivka area. By the way, this whole area with Ukraine had a counterattack a couple of months back and took a big swath of this, but they couldn't hold it. So they lost it all. And now that it's gone beyond where it was before, there's other areas down in Zaporizhia that are going on, of course. And this one here, this is the most significant one in terms of potential. This is what I was talking about here. You see that the Russians have moved overnight. Now, these may just be DRG groups that have gone out there, but you see it's only about 1 kilometer left between here. And then all of these troops down into this other part here, all the way down into this cauldron here, they have no way to get out.
Correct.
And they have, of course, no way to get fuel, reinforcements, ammunition, anything other than what they can deliver with drones. And that's not going to be very effective. Meanwhile, you see that in the city itself, there was another huge swash that was taken in the last 12 hours in Mirnograd, up in the upper right-hand corner. They took another swath. These are just within the last 12 hours. So these things continue going on. And what is it going to mean to Russia, especially after as long as they've been fighting for this, when this finally falls, what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on the Russian side?
Well, they view it as the ones calling the shots on this are the general staff. I just had a conversation with a retired General Buzhinsky, and he said, look, Putin is in the same position as Donald Trump as far as he's not a military guy, has no military experience. He is the titular head, though. He's the commander-in-chief under the Russian Constitution. However, the military decisions about the strategy to employ, where to employ resources and the overall plan of attack, that is being dictated by the general staff. And they regularly brief Putin on it, and Putin did give them guidance. He said, I want to minimize our casualties. We're in no rush. We don't need to go out and put people's lives unnecessarily at risk. So, you know, that's one of the reasons they've been moving very slowly and methodically. Once this area, Minograd and Pokrovsk, once that falls, that then leaves Lyman and Slavyansk, I believe, or Kramatorsk. That'll be the last defensive line there in Donetsk. That'll secure the complete capture of Donetsk. And then it's a wide open road across Dnipropetrovsk to the Dnipro River. And so, you know, Russia is going to settle this on the ground militarily.
Yeah, here's the Lyman area right here.
Yeah. They have offered, you know, they've offered a negotiated way out, but it requires the West to accept the fact that Crimea, Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, Luhansk are now permanent parts of Russia, of the Russia Federal Republic. They've not given them back. There's no negotiating over them. There's no, you can keep half of this. They are completely part of Russia, and Russia will secure them one way or the other. And Russia is not under the kind of economic pressure that the West continues to insist. And they certainly have not suffered the kinds of casualties that the West claims. It's just the opposite. Ukraine has suffered those casualties, and it's a simple math problem, because you look and compare number of artillery strikes by Russia vice artillery strikes by Ukraine. Well, in 2022, 2023, 2024, Russia was firing at a 10-to-1 advantage. Now it's about some reports. But again, I question these because they come from Ukrainian sources, say it's a 2-to-1 advantage, but it's still a 2-to-1 advantage. Similar with the drones, same advantage. With missiles, hypersonic missiles, total dominance. The Ukraine doesn't have anything, even with the occasional HIMAR or attack of missiles, to counter. And then when you look at the bombs delivered by aircraft. So when you're looking at the firepower that Russia has been delivering over the course of the last 3.5 years, a decisive advantage. And there's no way that, you know, if I have 8 bullets and you have 1 bullet, I can inflict a lot more damage than you can, which is exactly what has transpired. So and now we've seen Ukraine's loss of capability. They could mount an offensive in 2022, where they took back Kherson or forced the Russians to relinquish Kherson and Kharkiv. We saw in 2023, they filed that so-called counteroffensive that tried to penetrate the Suravikin lines, failed, but they still had mounted that offensive. Then in 2024, they mounted the Kursk offensive. Again, it was a war of attrition. They lost 70,000 guys at least. And then this year, nothing. Because they no longer have the manpower to pursue any kind of offensive and sustain a push.
And I want to, you mentioned the Kursk operation here. For those who may recall, we talked about this before. There was a big penetration up into this area into Russia. They completely restored it all. And this is the actual border between the two countries. And you see that Russia pushed all the way down. And now then they have a piece pushed into the Ukraine side. They haven't exploited that here in the last several months, but that's where they went after they shoved the Ukrainians out after, I think it was like 8 months total. One of the guys, I think it was the main commander who led that, is General Aptiyaludinov from the Russian side. And you had the opportunity that I have been trying to get and failing to do to interview him. Yeah. And that is actually posted on your Substack. What is that? Your website.
Yeah,
there,
my blog. 21, yeah.
Which we strongly recommend people go to take a look at there. But I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what you discovered from how the Russian side conducts its operational art. How do they conduct warfare?
Yeah. Aloudinov. Is that A-L-A-U? Got it. Aloudinov. What a gentleman. I was with him on at least three separate occasions. One night was at the Moscow Writers Club. Scott Ritter was there. General Apte was there. Steven Seagal was there. then I did the interview at TASS with General Apte. He's the next one down, Gary. There he is. And Apte he's a Muslim. He fought in the Chechen wars. He was from Chechnya. It was his unit of veterans. I just learned this. The guys that launched that 13-kilometer hike through a gas pipeline, it was 13 kilometers. They were veterans. These were not young guys. These were a bunch of 30-year-olds. And they, you know, you go try marching a mile hunched over, bent over at the waist, carrying ammunition, carrying your rifle. These are some hard men. I mean, hard as woodpecker lips. And they, Apte led them. And yet, when he was very upfront about it. He says, look, the United States doesn't have any experience like we do. Their army has never fought like we have fought.
I can vouch for that.
They're not prepared to deal with what we're capable of delivering. And if necessary, we will die in that process defending ourselves. This is about our homeland. This is about defending ourselves from the encroachment of the West, the threat that you pose. But he says, we prefer to live in peace. And, you know, here he is, a devout Muslim, and yet he is a devout patriot of Russia. He's recognized as a hero of Russia, you know, sort of their equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. I asked him about training standards, you know, we got talking. I said, if you have soldiers who can't make the standard, what happens to them? And he says, they don't fight. We don't, you know, you make the standard or else, you know, we don't have any special, you know, a yellow ribbon award, you know, a participation award. He didn't use that precise language, but that's what he meant, you know?
Yeah.
And, you come away with, that their vision, that they're under no rush. And he was insistent on his support for President Putin, that Russia was united behind this, and that, you know, that the West simply doesn't understand the kind of sacrifice that the Russians are willing to make to preserve themselves and their homeland. That was the message I came away with from him.
And how much might that be that it's like, oh, well, he's just trying to project this image of strength, you know, to an American, a Western audience that you would carry back. But, you know, really, they have a lot more trouble. How can you assess whether, you know, where that falls on that scale?
Yeah, it's zero on that scale. You know, look, I've been around enough people During my years of talking headism, you know, I did Crossfire with Pat Buchanan and Geraldine Ferraro. I can say, based on my experience, Aladinov, he's not a Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan's a bit of a blowhard, and he looks around to see, are you somebody I ought to talk to? Are you important or not? That's not Aladinov at all. He was very, he's very genuine. And I've been around enough general officers as well during my time working with JSOC. He's the real deal. You know, you look at him and say, man, I wish we had some of those in our army, because he leads by example. There were a couple of his, one was a war correspondent, and the other one was, one of his soldiers. And, you know, he doesn't treat them like subordinates, you know, where they have to step and fetch it. But you could tell the level of respect that they had for him was predicated. And Scott Ritter actually told me a story that there was during one of the battles, one of his soldiers was shot, went down, wounded. And it was Opti that ran out and grabbed him and drug him back to safety. I don't know if you've known any generals like that, but, he was remarkable. But I didn't just talk to him. I talked to at least two other, they were now retired generals. This one, Guruyov, he fought in the Chechen War. And another one that I'll post up tonight, he fought in Donetsk. And they're all, you know, the other two are like Christians. They come out of it from an Orthodox Christian background. But they are, they're very focused on the fact that they're going to win this. But they also acknowledge, you know, look, part of the problem is they're fighting their own relatives. This is a genuine civil war because the Ukrainians are Slavs, and they were, and the intermarriage that goes on between Slavs and Russians is quite extensive.
Got that mixed up there. What did you learn from any of your commentary with the Russians in that? Are they frustrated? Because we hear that from some sources in Russia, that they're frustrated that they're not going in bigger and harder, and they would like to say, we could get this war over with a lot faster, but we're being kept going slow. I know that the claim is to keep the friendly casualties low, but a lot of them say, no, we should be cut loose. How did you see any of that?
Yeah, this is the call of the generals. This is not Putin. No, those are claiming that there's all this animus towards Putin and they want to get rid of him. No. That's a very small group. It's not the majority of the population. But the ones calling the shots on the military strategy, that's the general staff. That's Gerasimov and the generals that surround him. So, and I talked, so I sat at TASS headquarters there, just north of the Kremlin. And I spoke with 28 different people. At least four members of the Russian legislature, the Duma, one of them being the number two guy in the Duma. I spoke with four different, actually, well-known military analysts that appear frequently on Russian television and sometimes in the West, including Dmitry Orlov was one. This notion that there's great frustration with Putin over not moving fast enough, it's just, you know, sorry, that is a minority view. I know people like Gilbert Doctorow have advanced that, but I didn't hear that at all. And look, I even met with the head of the Russian Communist Party, Zhuganov. Mm. He's a character, but, you know, he's an opposition party to Putin, but he supports Putin on the war, as well as his press spokesman. I spoke to him as well. So I said, this was not a group that was put together, especially to fool Larry Johnson, you know, and I was never told, oh, don't talk about this or don't ask about that. I could ask anything I wanted. I could bring up any topic I wanted. Now, I wasn't trying to be a jerk. I recognize I was a guest in their country and I was going to be polite and ask reasonable questions, but I wasn't in a position where I had to, kowtow to the, and yeah. say, oh, don't go there. Don't talk about that. It was, and the diversity of the group, it was a diverse group. I bet if I put them all in a room, they would have argued with each other. So guess what? It's not an authoritarian society that limits discussion.
That's interesting. And I want to ask a question based on this plurality of different folks that you talk to here, because what we have basically on the surface is that Russia and repeated by Putin and Lavrov often, even just within the last few weeks, that they desire a negotiated settlement. They desire to have a diplomatic end to this that they can live with, or they're going to continue to fighting on the ground. I was on our show earlier today. I interviewed Alistair Crook, and I asked him a pretty tough point blank question. And I want to show you what I asked him here and then get your response to the same question. Here's what he said. Given the history that you just talked about, I mean, let's run from MI6, CIA, going all the way back to 47, 40, 48, et cetera, that seeds that were planted then, is there, I mean, if we're just being honest, is there even a rational possibility to get to a negotiated denazification that's acceptable to Russia? Or literally, have we baked in that Russia can only have a military victory here and be satisfied?
I see no basis, as things stand, I see no basis for a negotiated settlement involving United States and Russia about Ukraine.
So that was really stark, because we'd gone back and forth with a number of different things. And, and we talked specifically about Putin's comment in Beijing last month where he said, it's either negotiations or military. And his assessment is, looking at the Western side, that there is no scenario that the requirement for denazification, demilitarization, and the territorial, and then the requirements for the Russian speakers living elsewhere in Ukraine, that they would agree to that. So he said, it seems to him the practical answer is that the only path will be a Russian military victory. Do they see it that way there too?
Absolutely. And Alistair's always very diplomatic in his, I admire his calm, patient, and diplomatic approach to it. But the fact is, I could say it, the humorous way is there are two ways that Russia would accept that kind of negotiated solution. No way and no way in hell. Okay, those are the two. It is, they've made it very clear that the deal on the table right now are those five former Ukrainian oblasts that are now part of Russia constitutionally, and that Ukrainian troops pull out, and that there is an election that will deal with this Nazi problem that they have in Western Ukraine, and that NATO gets out, backs off from Russia. But the West, oh, no, we can't do that. It's got to be a ceasefire in place. And Russia goes, okay, well, we're not going to agree to that. So we're going to continue moving into Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy, Poltava, Kharkiv, and Odessa. They're going to take them back. And they're going to take Kiev. That's where this is going to end. We'll probably a year from now, they'll be sitting in Kiev. And there's nothing the West can do about it.
With that, actually, that's not just a Russian position. Roger Boyce from the Times London, the Times this past Sunday, published an op-ed piece where he says, I hate to say this, but probably by the spring, I think Russia could be up to Kiev. That's what he said. That's not any of our commentary. That is somebody who's very much a pro-Ukrainian side, is just looking at the fundamentals, and they're coming to that same conclusion. All right, so if that be the case, if the Russians actually believe that too, then that means that they have to understand there's going to be a price to pay. And this most current one here is these new level of sanctions from President Trump against Lukoil and that other big giant. I can't think of it right off the top of my head. But those are something that Putin himself said, it's going to hurt, but we're going to work around it. Are they actually ready to say whatever has come so far and whatever may come later, is there a price that could be imposed on Russia that would cause him to stop short of what you just described there of going all the way to a military victory?
Let's first start with that. Those so-called sanctions that Trump and Bessent imposed, what a joke. I mean, because you read it and it says, yeah, if you do any transactions with U.S. banks and U.S. dollars, we're going to stop that. Well, Rosneft and then Luke Holt, you know, the other one, they're not doing that much business in U.S. dollars. In fact, the one Russian, the privately owned one, the Luftoil, is it? They just sold out. They just sold to a company in Switzerland. So the fact of the matter is that Russian oil is being purchased by India, for example. India is paying with yuan, Chinese currency. They're not paying with dollars. And when Russia sells to China, they're not paying with dollars. They're paying with the Chinese currency that's now backed by gold. So these are just meaningless sanctions. And it goes to the heart of this claim that, oh, Ukraine, man, we're destroying the Russian oil refineries. No, they're not destroying them by any stretch. They've damaged some, yeah. But I went around and looked at for gas lines in Moscow, and I saw John Helmer originally said, well, no, Larry was wrong. No, John, I'm absolutely right on this. It wasn't just in northern Moscow. It's in other parts of the country. The fact of the matter is Russia's not experiencing a massive shortage on the gas side. On top of that, I spoke with a fellow who was the former economic minister for East Russia, Siberia, the whole thing. He's got the number one selling book on the Russian economy. And, I asked him about all this, and he basically said, look, the reality is we in Russia, we don't need exports in order to grow our economy. Yeah, we export oil. And it's exported to places like China and India who refine the oil over there. But we don't need that. We've got everything in our country in terms of natural resources that we can feed our people and employ our people and grow our economy internally. But we do the international trade because it's a way to have additional influence in the world. And that's why we're shifting now to the global south and away from Europe and the United States. We'd like to have relations with them, but we don't depend on that. And our economy's not held hostage to it. That's what the West doesn't get. They think, oh, yeah, man, we're going to apply that pressure. They're going to holler uncle. They do not care.
Well, on that question, is there a price that could be imposed that whether they have it now or not? That could be so severe that Russians would say, you know what, it's just the juice ain't worth the squeeze. This is just too much. We're just going to go ahead and stop it on the current line of contact. Does that exist?
No, does not exist. If the U.S. wants to go nuclear, all right, good luck with that. We'll find out who's got the better air defense system and who's got the capability to actually deliver the weapons to target. That's it. Beyond that, there is nothing the West can do to put pressure on Russia because Russia, I mean, for God's sake, they don't understand. Russia's the only country in the world that's self-sufficient in terms of all natural resources. The United States is like number three on that list. You could build a wall around Russia. And it wouldn't need to import a single damn thing from any other country. It's already now building its own commercial airliners. Before, because it wanted to be, thought it could be part of the modern world, it was buying from Boeing or from Airbus. And then we sanctioned them and we're not buying our airplanes anymore. They went, okay, we'll make our own, which they have done.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
So, hey. Good job in Washington, man, because instead of building a relationship with the Russians, you're driving them away.
And all these sanctions we did in the immediate aftermath of the February 2022 with the massive exodus of all the Western business and stuff in Russia, caused some near-term pain, but then just taught them that they can do their own or look elsewhere. And now then all of that leverage point are gone.
Yeah. So the, you know, McDonald's has changed its name, and the Russian owns the old McDonald's chain. Starbucks, same thing. It's now Star something or other. So, you know, but you actually still see some Western businesses wanting to get in there because it's a market. Russia is a prosperous country now. And this notion that we're going to collapse the Russian economy, they've been there. They've got the T-shirt, 1991 to 1999. They had an economic collapse. They had a middle class that dropped dramatically. They had a loss of life where the lifespan of the average male dropped from like 63 to 56. They had widespread suicide. They've been there. They've suffered through that. They're done suffering in that regard. And that in part, they remember as being caused by the West. Instead of the West stepping in to help and say, hey, let's go with this transition, the West did everything they could to try to take advantage, to rape Russia. And that's what Putin put a stop to, which is one of the reasons there's such animus against Putin, because he stopped our own oligarchs from enriching themselves at the expense of the Russian people. So now, does Russia have some economic, you know, they've had inflation, and Nabulina, the head of the central bank, she's not a very popular person in some sectors because they don't like her policies to try to bring down inflation. But there's a significant portion of the economic class in Russia that's terrified of having the hyperinflation they did in the 1990s. So they're avoiding that. So, but the point of it is the United States has no pressure point over Russia that we can make them hurt. They got
the bottom line. And I think that what you just said there is more important than some people might recognize. In our lifetimes, in our adult lifetimes, they have lived through profound cost and profound suffering. And of course, I've talked to some Russians who talked about the decades prior to that, and they had several other rounds where there were lots of trouble. They know how to suffer. They're nothing even close to suffering that level of stuff. And yet they still didn't like turn against the state and whatever else. And so I don't think that there's anything that we could do, even if there are some sanctions that can be found and manufactured that could genuinely hurt, that would cause Russia to say, okay, our national security issues aren't that important. We'll just forget about it and let the NATO stay in Ukraine. I just don't think that it even exists.
Yeah. Well, and look at our sanctions against Cuba. Cuba's still there. Look at our sanctions against Iran.
That's a good point.
The Ayatollah's still there. So, this and one of the guys brought this up. You know, he's the co-founder of the International Unity Club. He says, you know, the problem with you Americans, he says, you think only in terms of zero-sum game. You gotta win and they gotta lose.
Yeah.
You never look for solutions that are a positive-sum game where everybody can win. Because our Russian approach is we're looking for that everybody comes out a winner approach, which is one of the reasons that Russia has been a leader within the BRICS movement, because they're not sitting there to say, we're going to become the new hegemon. It's really not in their DNA. The notion that, you know, again, they float, oh, Russia's trying to create the Soviet empire. It's because they had control over the countries that are on their periphery. Gee, we don't do that here in the United States now, do we? Oh, yeah, tell that to Venezuela. You know, I mean, frankly, we are so full of crap in this country where we delude ourselves all the time and fail to look in the mirror and take an objective assessment of who we are and how we have conducted ourselves over the last 60, 70 years.
Yeah, we don't even look the 6 or 7 days, as a matter of fact. And I do want to, before I let you go, I want to shift gears over to the Venezuela situation, kind of to get your assessment of where that is and where it may be going, because it's starting to look a lot more like in the open. Don't have to read many tea leaves for this one. I think it was Lindsey Graham and maybe a couple of others that have outright said on television, on the Sunday shows, that Maduro can either walk away, he can be assassinated, or there's going to be a coup on him inside. But one of the other things, that now then we're just outright openly going for a regime change conflict. We've got a fair amount of combat power in the region, so it's not an empty threat here. And I think you and I have talked before, it's like Trump tried a ham-fisted with John Bolton leading the effort with Juan Guaido in his first administration, which was a disaster and humiliating failure. Now it looks like they're not going to just try and hope to foment something inside. It looks like they're going to try and bring military power to bring something to bear inside. First question is, what the hell? Why are we even worried about trying to create something inside of Venezuela? How does that help us?
Yeah, it's all about the oil, I think, to get control of.
But see, that Maduro offered basically on a silver platter, and Trump actually used the F word because he was so mad about it. He didn't want to win like that. They want him out. How does those things go together? I don't.
Well, they
that
don't. Look, there's no rationality here on the part of the Trump administration. You know, number one, they're lying. They're absolutely, totally lying about the role of Venezuela as being this major player in the narcotics trafficking world. Look, when I set up Berger, I was one of five people that set up Berger Associates in 1998, consulting firm. And when we were done, there are three of us. One of my partners was the former chief of international operations of DEA. He's the one that set up what was known as the Kingpin program in 1980. My other partner set up all the undercover money laundering operations for DEA in New York City. And Berger Associates, we spent, you know, go back the now it's 27 years. Over the course of that 27 years, we did a lot of investigations that dealt with narcotics trafficking out of Colombia, out of Panama, out of Ecuador, out of Mexico. Venezuela was never much on that list. Venezuela was a place where you saw a lot of money laundering. You saw a lot of product counterfeiting. In the case that we filed, a RICO case we filed against Philip Morris on behalf of the European Union, we had evidence of Philip Morris executives flying into Venezuela, paying off border guards and going in an armored vehicle into Colombia to a city called Maical, which is up in the northeast corner of Colombia. And there they met with a Colombian senator by the name of Santander López Sierra. López Sierra was known as the Marlboro Man. In fact, Philip Morris even went to Colombia and filmed him with the Marlboro Man commercial, you know, riding a horse. The problem was he was a, you know, fat guy. He looked like a watermelon with feet. Okay.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But
that's, you know, quite an imagery.
Yeah. You said poor horse. But at that point, they deliver to these Philip Morris executives third party checks, U.S. postal money orders. And Philip Morris executives took it back across the border. They deposited it into a Venezuelan bank. And then the Venezuelan bank would ship it to a Russian bank. And then it made its way from the Russian bank into the bank accounts controlled by Philip Morris. Now, part of the reason I know that is I'm sitting here, I've got the bank records from those Russian banks, because that came out of a different case. So with all that as background, I have some knowledge and experience with this. The Trump administration is lying about the drug threat coming out of Venezuela. And that first boat that they had, that they blew up, the 60-foot cigarette boat, had four outboard motors on it. The distance from the north coast of Venezuela to the southern border of the United States in those Florida Keys is about 1,300 miles. That 60-foot cigarette boat with four outboard motors can only go 250 miles before it needs to be refueled. Well, you got 11 people on board? Where are the drugs? Because you're going to need at least 300 5-gallon jerry cans to keep filling that boat up so you can make it to the United States. It's not cost effective. That's not how drug traffickers work. This is a lie. And the United States is
murdering. You control that imagery we had from just today. There's going to be a picture here where one missile takes out two boats. And for all the life of me, they look empty. It doesn't look like there's anything in it at all. So I'm not sure what that's supposed to be all about. But we keep claiming that we have all these. I forget the number now. I see it's quite a lot now. And around 50 people have been summarily executed just because we claim that they're carrying drugs or so. How does that play into this whole, I don't even know what you call it, fiasco, this picture that we're drawing? Well, now, there's a lot on that boat there. That one had something, quite a bit of something on it. But this one in a minute, you'll see two in a row that looks to me like it's just almost empty.
Well, I don't discount the possibility that you're seeing AI-created videos. Or CIA created videos where they'll take a couple of boats.
Yeah, see it right there.
Yeah, they'll take a couple of boats, put them out there, and we blow them up, and then we get to claim that they're carrying drugs.
What do you make of those two boats that you see as best you understand?
Yeah, that you're not hauling drugs. It's ridiculous. And that one's got at least, what is that, 3 outboard motors? Again, it does. They don't have the ability to make it to the United States. And it's not like there are gas stations all along the way. I mean, it's a garbage story from the outset. But I don't doubt that some of those boats are involved with smuggling cigarettes and liquor back and forth. You know, that's definitely happens. You know, Aruba, Curacao, those are two big places for just off the coast of Colombia and Venezuela, Bonaire, that are used to transit a lot of contraband, but not narcotics. I mean, that's a big money business, and those are handled with bigger accounts. The biggest one is flows across the Mexican border, not Venezuela. So this is the CIA, but going back to 2018, because in 2018, I believe that Donald Trump, based upon what I've seen in public, signed a finding that authorized the CIA to put in place a plan to overthrow the government of Maduro. And included in that plan was using this group, Tren de Aragua, as the pretext of, oh boy, they're the human smuggler, drug trafficking kings. So we got to, they were used by the CIA to help build a narrative to justify this kind of action. And it's shameful. It is illegal what the United States is preparing to do. And again, we've George W. Bush with the AUMF that was signed after 9/11, the authorization for use of military force. That became the justification, the excuse to go out and kill people that we just decide are bad. Instead of going by the normal rules, which is the only way you can take somebody's life is if they pose an immediate threat to take yours or to cause serious, grievous bodily harm. Otherwise, you don't have the right to kill them.
Right. And yet, yeah, and certainly none of that.
We've now got George W. Bush killing people, Barack Obama killing people, Biden killing people, and Trump killing people. We've got a bunch of murderers as national leaders.
So let me ask you this again, before we run out of time here. A lot of the Venezuela stuff is left over from the first administration, and we've been talking about some of that. But now here recently, and I'm talking about with just the last few weeks, for some reason, they moved this crosshairs over to Colombia as well. And now we're demonizing their leader, which he's just infuriated about what's been going on here. What can you tell us about what's going on with Colombia? Because, and you may correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not an expert down in this area, but I thought that we had pretty good relations with Colombia for going back a long time. What happened?
Well, the president that's come in, Petro, he's considered a leftist. So we're immediately ideologically opposed to him just by virtue of him, quote, being a leftist, number one. But we've hit, the cooperation on, trying to combat the drug trafficking out of Colombia. Good Lord. When I worked at state counterterrorism in 1989, 90, 91, my first boss was Morris Busby. And Buzz later in 92, he went to Colombia as the ambassador, and he was there during the entire hunt for Pablo Escobar. If anybody has watched the Netflix series Narcos, well, they have Ambassador Crosby. Well, that's Ambassador Busby. Mm-hmm. And, the CIA chief of station at the time, a guy named Bill Wagner. Bill's a friend. The DEA chief, Joe Toft. So this goes back. And that was where, my business partner, now retired, set up the Kingpin program. Because the thought behind the Kingpin program was that if you kill or capture the leaders of these narcotics cartels, that will cause them to collapse. Well-intentioned thought. It turned out when you take out those cartels, it's like hitting a ball of mercury with a hammer. Boop! All of a sudden, you got all these little mercury balls running around. because there's so much money involved.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You think I got the head, but no one's going to leave that network dead because they want to make they want to take that money.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, my I thought I had a 3 p.m., but I'm good. I don't have to jump off. But what happened is the nexus between U.S. corporations, U.S. businesses, U.S. banks grew very, very close with these narcotics cartels. These cartels couldn't do what they want without the cooperation of U.S. businesses and banks. And you know, I can give you just one real simple example that I worked on firsthand. I was doing due diligence for a bank in Panama. They said, hey, we got these this new e-commerce site. These two guys, one's a Ukrainian and one's a Spaniard. And I said, oh, and they're in Panama. Yeah, that's not unusual. And they're selling soap online. I'm thinking, soap online? You know, if I was looking to start an internet business, soap wouldn't be at the top of my list. But okay. So I said, and they said, what we're getting is all these credit card transactions out of this bank in Texas. And so I said, okay, give me a list of the transactions. So I got, you know, the names of the people, their address, their phone number, social security number, and, you know, and how much they purchased. And when you looked at the purchases, it was reflected what I call structuring. And the structuring means, you know, you got like two or three amounts that keep appearing over and over. It wasn't like a random assignment of numbers. So I started calling the people on the list as I was pretending to be the customer service rep for the soap online company. And everyone was like, what soap? I didn't buy any soap. And so then then I finally figured out these were debit cards. So what had happened was this drug trafficking organization in the United States went to this bank in the United States, bought a bunch of debit cards. They provided the bank with all the names, all the know your customer information you're supposed to have, taken off of the dark web, names, addresses. What was interesting is with each one of them, there's always like one thing off, you know, like a phone number wasn't correct or an address was incorrect. Something was off, but they looked legit. And so let's just say the way you make that deal, you go to the bank and say, hey, I'd like to buy $1.5 million worth of debit cards, and I'll give you $2 million for it. Bank jumped at it. And then what would happen is they would run these charges on these debit cards that they had, and then the money would be deposited into this bank in Panama, and then the bank in Panama would then be given instructions to wire it to a bank in Cyprus. So once I, you know, figured this out and I told the bank threw the penalty flag and they shut down the business. But it's an example, it's just one example, because these people are incredibly creative that are on the drug trafficking side. And I saw it. They used John Deere. They used Wachovia Bank. You know, so if we want to deal with the drug problem, let's start here at home with our own corporations, our own companies, our own financial institutions.
Yeah, but that ain't happening anytime soon.
Oh, of course not. In fact, me and my partners, we had a deal back in, I want to say it was 2014, with the government of Mexico. We would, my two partners went to Mexico City, were prepared to sign a deal with the government of Mexico to bring a civil racketeering case against Wachovia Bank. Eric Holder intervened and threatened Mexico that there would be punishment if they went ahead with this. Why? Because Wachovia Bank made generous contributions to Mr. Barack Obama and company. So, this kind of hypocrisy, and then we justify it by going out and killing people? That we don't know.
So where is this going? Just in the last few minutes we have here, that's all the stuff that's going to stay in the because too many people have a benefit of doing that, unfortunately. What's going to happen on the ground here with Venezuela and Colombia? Do you think that there's going to be a regime change in Venezuela, and what's going to happen to Colombia?
They're going to attempt regime change. I think the United States is going to get embroiled in a war in Venezuela that we can't win. I'll say that Venezuela is Spanish for Vietnam. Okay. It's a big country. You know, if the U.S. wants to fly in there with helicopters, good luck with that. The Venezuelan army and paramilitary units, they have ample supplies of surface, shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles. So they've got that. If you try to put U.S. troops on the ground, the ambush sites are ample. And the size of the country, it is huge. It's not a little tiny country like Panama, you know, where you can drive across it in an hour, hour and a half. You know, we are going to kill some Venezuelans, and we're going to kill innocent people. And then we're going to ignite a level of anti-American sentiment throughout Central and South America. You know, I saw this in Panama. When we were doing an investigation on product counterfeiting back in 2000, 2001, there's this one little port on Colón. It's called Coco Solo, the Lone Coconut. And they have all these little boats, costales, that sail along the coast, and they carry refrigerators, air conditioners, household appliances, domestic, you know, rice cookers, coffee makers. They're the main smuggling route into Colombia. And while I was there one day, I was talking with one of the women who worked there, and she recounted how we killed her two children during our operation in 1989 to take out Manuel Noriega. We killed two of her small children. And she didn't hate me, thank God. But that's there's a human cost that comes with this that we never pay.
Yeah.
We never accept. And, you know, the killing, you know, we still have not learned the lesson. You can't kill your way to peace.
Yeah. Never works. What about Colombia? What is this just something he just wants to stir the pot up, or is there anything going to happen there?
No, well, I think they're creating more of a, you know, they've kicked the hornet's nest. Whatever incentive Colombia had previously to try to crack down on drug trafficking, they're just going to say, you know, screw it. The drug trafficking cost is real here in America in terms of loss of lives.
Yeah.
I agree with what's been said about it. We've lost more people to the epidemic of drugs in the United States. But clean it up here at home.
Right, 100%.
You know, we allow the distribution, and we don't do the treatment. And, you know, you've got city after city. Tucker Carlson, he did a great piece on it last night, running down just the disaster that you see in places like Philadelphia, at Kensington Avenue, and in other places. What we're doing is, instead of forging a closer relationship with Colombia, and Lord knows we have trained a boatload of Colombian soldiers over there. I mean, you've got people that have been trained by CIA as well as U.S. military going back 40 years. And so you've got a bunch of guys who are militarily capable. You've got some who've been fighting in Ukraine who are going to maybe come home and realize they've been betrayed by the United States. We're getting ready to create a military problem that we're not capable of resolving. We don't have the will to send the number of troops in there and take the kinds of casualties we would take.
And that wouldn't work. It wouldn't create anything more. Yeah. We shouldn't do any, because no matter what the number is, it'll be too many and will be pointless. But listen, we really appreciate you coming on today. And man, so many issues you covered for us today. This is really awesome and very much appreciated. Be sure and go see this article on sonar21.com. Always a great bunch of great stuff there. But the Trump administration is gaslighting regarding Russia's military capabilities. That's down toward the bottom. You're going to have the General Apte article on there. I recommend people go and see that. I will be one of them who are going to go watch it. Thanks very much, Larry, for coming on today. Always appreciate you.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much, Danny.
We will see you next time. And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that before you left. That helps us more than you may think. Also, we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and then share that information with your friends, because we're unintimidated and uncompromised, and we want to make sure that you can get that information out so that other people have access to the same information you do. Thanks very much, folks, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.